Investing Insights with Right Property Group. Exploring trends in real estate and helping property investors gain financial security.
Hello everyone and welcome to Property Investing Insights, our recorded version without the larrikin Phil. And we're here in our studios today and back on our Facebook Live. And if you haven't been following our Facebook Live, you should just go onto our Facebook page. Back on our recent Facebook Live, we've been inundated with requests to bring back the two finance experts that said everything there is about property investing and mortgages. There were some really good gems in there. And what we thought, Steve, today was that we would expand on that and ask the questions that did come in after we went off live and also add to the gems that we did get from both Z and Wayne from Investify. But before we do that, Steve, obviously markets change on a weekly basis. And this is no different. Markets have changed. We are rapidly adjusting to the changing finance and the changing market as such. And what are you seeing out there in the market?
That's a good point around rapidly adjusting, because I think people's opinions are rapidly adjusting as well. Like just before we came in here, I was reading some headline articles from the bank. I think it was from Westpac, and they've once again adjust what their price forecasts in terms of growth are for the rest of the year and for the next and for the next. Now, every bank has done so, as we all read over the last, since COVID, really. It's really where it started to amplify in terms of those reporting numbers. But you could argue that you would just do exactly what they've predicted. Because it's always following, it's always wrong. We're going to see growth drop or value drop. It's gone the other way.
Eventually they'll be right.
Well, it's a bit like a weather forecast. You could be in the middle of a drought and say it's going to rain tomorrow and one day it will, you know. But to be fair to the banks and the economists and those that do commentate at that level, there are so many moving parts. It's so fickle that it's really going against what, dare I say it, common sense and market conditions should predict if you look at it from a surface level. But as we dig deeper and we know about the undersupply, we know about immigration, we know about construction crisis, all of that, as we've kept talking about, is really has and will continue to set the stage in terms of what growth is or is not doing around the country today.
Yeah, and generally all this forecast and these predictions and the sentiment is based on generalized information. Right, and we really need to get granular with it and really need to know how each moving part is impacting on the others. And a big play on all of this, and this is why we brought in our two guests, is that all of this is for nothing if you don't get the oxygen for property investing, which is money, the folding stuff. And the years of investing that both you and I have seen, the years of advising clients that you and I have done, one of the cardinal mistakes people make is that they either choose the wrong finance provider or they use finance as more of a backstop rather than being the windshield for your investing, in terms of you're always looking forward as to what is to be predicted in terms of finance and therefore the property you're buying. To that effect, I'd like to welcome our guests, Wayne and Z from Investify. They've forgotten more than I know about finance and certainly have helped many clients with multiple property portfolio build up a war chest for times like this. So guys, welcome.
Thanks, Vic.
So I guess we jump straight into it, Steve, right? And we'll throw the questions at them and we'll try and catch them out.
I've got the first question.
Go for it.
What are rates doing next quarter? Up or down? There you go.
Do you have a coin handy?
Yeah, it's pretty much that way, isn't it? It's, but I guess to kick the conversation off, following on from Vic, I think the big question in and around the majority of people will be, when are we going to see an easing lending environment? You know, as we've talked about before and we did on various platforms, it's not the cost of money all the time. It's about show me the money.
I mean, everybody's been asking that, not just in the last few weeks, months, but
forever.
Forever. And especially since rates started increasing, 18 months ago? So when's it going to get easier? When's it going to get easier? And for the past, I think, you know, 1 to 2 years, it's just been getting harder and harder. But recently, over the last couple of months, we're just starting to see some rays of sunshine coming through, right?
Yeah, we've seen some 1% buffers brought in for lenders for dollar refinances, which is a great sign.
Yeah.
And I think coupled with that, we've got a couple of lenders with a 2% buffer on purchases. So that's really kind of helped some clients that were stuck probably 4 or 5 months ago, being able to get into the market, which is great to see.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, because these rays of sunshine that you're, I guess, referring to, we really wouldn't have taken into perspective back in the midst of the COVID crisis, because money was just being flung around left, right, and centre. Yes, it was pretty easy to get. Yes. But as we create our portfolios, or as people continue to borrow money, or even initially want to borrow money, the clear, I guess, repercussion of the higher interest rates is you just can't get what you want in a lot of cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you need to pay for it.
I think that's such a good point, that like for people who already have debt, like what we were just saying about those 1% buffers and the streamlined refinances, you're able to refinance your debt out of maybe a high interest rate or high repayment loan. But in terms of being able to continue to grow your portfolio, that's the challenge now, isn't it?
Yeah, good point, because there's a lot of people that, and I would argue this point, and we're quite fortunate to be able to speak to a lot of different people, that the majority want to do something. They want to keep expanding on the portfolio. It's just, once again, it's that lack of ability. So what you're seeing now is still the desire to do so, but the ability clearly isn't there, and so people are just happy refinancing into a better rate. That's a win.
Yeah, yeah. That's the basic. Right? Mm. That really aims at people who are really struggling with their repayments. They've seen their rates go from sub 2% all the way up to 6%. And they're wanting to know what they need, what they can do.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, it doesn't really help those people who are like, well, you know, I've got some equity. I'm kind of on the border. 2 years ago, I could afford another investment property. I didn't take the opportunity at that point. What do I do now? How do I get into it?
There's a lot of pent up demand. Probably 12 months ago, 80% of clients could pull the trigger on a purchase. Now the conversations are probably 30 to 40% who are able to expand the portfolio, and that's just because the rates have jumped so far so quickly.
Yeah, and that's a significant drop in the number of people that can actually do something, right? It doesn't mean that others don't want to.
I guess in times like this, right, there's a lot of people that start panicking, right, and they start selling properties without actually doing all the sums. And often, from a lending perspective, they end up selling the wrong property. So what's your advice, Wayne, if someone who's looking at their portfolio and thinking, this is getting a little bit too hard to hold on to, it's starting to impact lifestyle, should I sell, should I not? And what are my finance options? What should they do first?
Yeah, for sure. I guess you never want to be in the position when you have to sell when the market's not a seller's market either. Mm-hmm. So I guess you really need to break down their household and what they're spending. Can they tighten the belt with discretionary spending first? Mm-hmm. Can we go to the current lenders and improve their interest rate to help their cash flow? Is there any opportunity to take advantage of those 1% buffer rates? Can we get any rental income increases? Are there any, you know, leases coming to expiry that we can pump up a little bit? And then I guess once you've had that global overview of the portfolio, if they really need to, then they can pull the trigger on it. But I guess you want to be selective as well with the property you're selling.
Yeah, so rather than being reactive, you need to be proactive in the approach of, first of all, your mortgages. And Steve and I talk a lot about mortgage restructures with our clients, right? So I guess for the uninitiated, see what's really a mortgage restructure and what's the process?
Mortgage restructure is really when we look at all the lending that the clients have in light of their current situation, in light of their current properties that they own, and determine what the most optimal structure is for their mortgages in light of their situation and the properties that they have. So, for instance, let's say that they've got some significant amounts of debt against the home that they live in. And there may be an opportunity, you know, they're coming into an inheritance, or they're getting some bonus or so forth, and there's an opportunity for us to clear some of that debt. Or maybe they're looking at selling one of their properties, right?
Yeah.
And then we have an opportunity to restructure their mortgage. So it could be a combination of refinancing, clearing debt, switching products, switching lenders, reducing repayments, consolidating other debt. There's quite a wide scope around what it is and what it could be, and what that is really best done is to really sit down with somebody who understands finance, somebody who understands property, and then take the steps to determine what all of those best levers to pull are.
Exactly. And I think a good example for a client that we've done that for is they were going to sell a property. They had a heap of equity in the other property, so actually moved all the lending from that property across to the portfolio. So they netted, you know, the full sale proceeds, which is a massive buffer and gives them that opportunity in the future to restructure, expand again.
As opposed to if, say, they were cross-collateralized with a different client, you know, we've seen in the past, right? And they sold a property, but the banks would control where the profits and those funds of that sale would go, just because they were cross-collateralized.
Mm-hmm. That. We did talk about that on the Facebook Live. Is there ever a time to cross-securitize? And we told the story. So go back to the website, have a look at the Facebook Live, and I guess you'll see us explain it a little further. But I guess from a top-line point of view, cross-securitization really, I guess, takes the risk mitigation away from yourself. However, it could be argued there is a time and a place to do it as a last resort.
Absolutely. We're not saying it's necessarily always a good or always a bad.
Correct.
However, when there's an opportunity, when you're coming up to a big milestone event like selling a property, or changing a job, or, you know, having another dependent, or, you know, one partner going on maternity leave or paternity leave, then, you know, always sort of revisit, see if there's an opportunity to restructure, because you may already have a pretty good structure, right? However, is there an opportunity based on what you're wanting to do? If you're wanting to sell a property in 2 years and you're thinking, actually, you know what, it would be really nice for me to keep some of that debt or clear some of that debt, then there are things that we can do. Debt recycling, cross-securitization or uncrossing, partial discharges, security substitutions, the list goes on.
Yeah. So there's right? a million things
there's,
there. Which,
there's yeah. so many variables, right?
Yeah. So you're not going to make a decision without the consultation to your advisor, your broker, and your accountant. So don't pull the trigger until you've really dug deep on what the ramifications are, or potentially what levers you need to pull beforehand. Coming back to your question.
Yeah. I love the way you put it. You know, it's a windshield. You know, finance is a windshield rather than, like, you know, a rearview mirror. It's something that you need to be planning for, looking at, using to... Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, let's take that example, though, as a windshield. And let's wind back probably 4 years ago or thereabouts, 3 years ago. And while we had this very liquid market in terms of the ability to get finance, I think you would have been an idiot if you thought that those days were going to last forever, right? So it's a moment in time.
Sure.
Using the windshield, looking forward, I guess, analogy, people should have recognized that it was a moment in time and utilized that safely to their best ability, even down to the point where, and Wayne, I hear you talk about this probably about as much as I do, and that's liquidity. So if you go back to, say, 21, 22, when valuations were at their best, the market was red hot, would have been a great time to utilise the better lending environment, the easier lending environment, draw down equity, park it into itself as buffers and liquidity, so that you weren't, now coming back to your question to the guys, Vic, about, you know, if people wanting to sell. Because at the end of the day, the state of your wallet dictates the state of your mind, so have the money before you need it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Exactly. That equity release when things were easier just gives you a big bucket of funds that you can call upon when things do go wrong, emergency repairs, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And to be fair, you guys were saying it back 4 years ago, and you know, you were telling our clients to do that, release equity and be ready for the opportunity. And I guess, yeah, sure, nobody knew it was going to be at, you know, the magnitude that it was, you know, 40% increases over COVID and the such like. But, you know, a lot of clients were. If you had your time again, you would do all of that and more if you could.
Well, right? If you had your time again, you would have bought four times.
Yeah, that's right.
Would have locked in at 2.99 for as long as you could.
10 years from now, people are going to be saying exactly the same thing. Right?
Great point. Mm. We can have that conversation and sort of analyze it just over how long we've been doing this and investing, and yourself.
Yeah.
You know, like, you think back to these milestone moments over the last decade or two, and it becomes super, super obvious in hindsight.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think people should use those obvious moments in time to look forward a little bit. But the epicenter of everything is finance.
Because what are people going to be saying 5-10 years from now? Oh, wow, interest rates were so high, I should have known to buy, right? Like, I really should have known, because nobody else, you know, a lot of other people were struggling with their household budgets, cost of living, inflation. I really should have, you know, knuckled down and bought those two or three properties at that point.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to be saying. That's what 100%. We're all going
to
be saying.
Particularly now, when we're potentially almost at the peak of the rate cycle, because it'll just take one thing in the media to change and say there's going to be a boom, and then everyone's going to jump in the market.
Yeah, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you do take that, like, let's explore that. So we're potentially at the end of the rate cycle, right? So some would argue that we've reached terminal cash rate. So if that's the case, knowing the other side of the equation in and around supply, construction, low vacancy rates and everything like that, I can nearly guarantee in the years to come, people will look back at this moment in time, further to your point, Z, around, well, shoulda, woulda, coulda, you know, but I didn't, because I was waiting for that, I guess, that physical proof that other people were doing it and other people were making money as a tick box event.
And the reality of it is, right, that no one can actually predict a boom, right? But this is probably the only exception where we can actually predict that there is going to be another boom. It's just that whether it's next year or in the next couple of years, it's not going to be 10 years down the track, definitely, because everything that we've got that creates a boom is there, except finance. And the minute finance handbrake gets released, we've got people, like you said, Wayne, that are waiting on the sidelines, right? They're making inquiries to say, how much can I borrow? And the minute they are able to borrow at a level that they can, that they prefer to purchase a meaningful property, the floodgates will open.
Exactly. And I think that's why it's so important to constantly review your situation, because you may not be able to get in now, but as things get easier, there will be a point in time where the finance inflects the market. Mm-hmm. And you can get a good quality asset. And
so how often do things change in finance?
Monthly, if the rates keep going up.
Great answer. <Yeah.
laughs> I think a 3-month review is pretty good, particularly if the rates go on hold or if they come down. If they start coming down, it's almost a monthly review if you're really trying to get into the market. Yeah.
That's a good point too, because if rates stay the same, let's just take off the table that rates are going to reduce in the foreseeable future, let's just be that conservative approach. But you would imagine, if that's the case, that there's going to be some tweaks to the back end in terms of serviceability, whether it be on buffer rates for purchasing or...
Well, it automatically is now, isn't it? It the serviceability is tied to the actual rates that you're paying and you're going to be paying. So any movement on your rates, because let's face it, most people are now on variable rates, right? So the minute the rates change, then it's likely that your serviceability changes. We've seen that over the past 2 years. As rates continue to increase, people's serviceabilities have gone down. Mm. But now it might be the other way around.
Could be. And then that will see a whole heap of other people into the market that are on the sidelines at the moment. Absolutely. Actually, coming back to market conditions, and Vic, at the beginning of the podcast, we're talking about what are we seeing in the market. The amount of people that continually go to open, this is from our buyer's agents' reports over the weekend, the amount of people that are going to open homes, going to inspections in, I guess, a state of mental preparation for when they can get the money. So they're not taking their eye off the market. They're not taking their finger off the pulse. They're just keeping keyed in, so that when they can get the money, they can pounce, which is very different from yesteryear where people wouldn't do anything. They'd just go, go on vacation in their head, between their ears until the market moved, and then they would re-key.
Because people are after social proof of growth, right?
Correct.
And the reality is that we've had immense social proof very recently. So people are very cognizant of growth, so they're ready to jump in. Now, Z, you brought in a concept of actually retaining debt when you're selling properties, right?
Yes, yes.
In what cases would you retain debt? Would it be imminent business or lifestyle change?
Yeah, it's a good point. When you have a property that you're selling, and you've got two options. You can either retain some of that debt or clear some of that debt. You need to consider whether it's in your interest to do one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's just say you've got your home, right? It's a $1 million home. You've got let's just call it $400,000, right? Of mortgage against that home. However, only $200,000 is your owner-occupied home because you bought it ages ago, maybe 15 years ago. You paid a small amount. You've paid that loan down to $200,000. But that an extra $200,000 actually pertains to another property, for instance, an investment property. Yeah, and you're going to retain that investment property. You're selling your home. Okay, so the uneducated investor goes and says, okay, I'm going to sell my home, $400,000 of debt, even though $200,000 actually pertains, is for the purposes of the other investment property. Oh, like my bank or my broker said, I need to, when I sell it, it goes away, right? The $400,000 goes away. But there's an alternative, isn't there?
Yeah, well, there's two. So I guess prior to the sale, you can do a refinance process, refinance the deductible investment loan back to the investment property you've purchased that's ideally gone up in value.
Yeah.
Or a little bit easier is what's called a security substitute, where if the properties are with the same lender, you can avoid the refinance process and literally substitute that loan split onto the investment property.
Mm-hmm. So right now, people listening to this are going, hang on, rewind.
well, then do it.
Let's do it again. So, as essentially, it would be a time for you to rewind or get in touch with the guys at Investify, because there's a little bit of complexity around there, not so much in the actions, but just in the understanding.
In the forethought.
Yeah, in the understanding. And getting your head around.
And I think it brings up an important point that the finance process is, a lot of the times, it's incremental, especially for investors and active investors. So you've got a situation and you know that you want to build your portfolio, you want to retire with a passive income, you want to create wealth through property, there are so many things that you could do over the next few years, even though you can't necessarily at this point in time make that purchase. There are so many steps that you could do. You could plan for that sale, or you could improve the rates that you're on and repayments that you've got right now. And then the next step might be to make sure that that's all settled. You're going along with much better and more reasonable rates and repayments. And then maybe the next step is to draw some equity, do some valuations of your properties, draw some equity, and then be ready. And then the next step might be the purchase. So, you know, but all of these steps may take anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks to, 3 months, depending on the complexity of your situation, depending on the properties, depending on all of those things. So depending on the staging and sequencing. So, there's so much planning and execution that needs to happen in between, just thinking, oh, I want to buy a property. Oh, how do I get the finance?
Which is how most people think about it, right? And I just don't think that the general person understands how important the finance piece is. Yeah, it is at the epicenter of everything, because without it, you can't do a goddamn thing, right? It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And people are too, I guess, too laid back in their approach to it, because ultimately, as we said on the Facebook Live the other day, the broker's job is to, I guess, put together a business proposition, a business plan to the multiple lenders and go to market on the borrower's behalf. But if you're not even thinking about it at that same level of sophistication, how can your broker do so? So, like, go to them with a goal. This is what I want to achieve. Be open and frank too. Don't try and hide anything. Don't, well, yeah. Hang on, you didn't tell me about this credit card that had, you know, been called on. So, like, be very, very honest with your broker and they'll do the best job for you.
100%. And I think it's got to be planned out, because probably the best example I see is clients wanting to buy multiple properties. They're a little bit conservative at the start. They've got a fair bit of equity in their own home and they'll go, hey, this is a bit new to us. We only want to buy one property. You release that 100-150K of equity for the first purchase. For the actual purchase, you need to go to a more generous lender, better serviceability, slightly higher interest rate. They go through that process and go, hey, that worked out really well. Let's buy number two. And then it's a hard conversation, because they've taken the step away from that mainstream lender with good rates and left a lot of equity on the table. So it's really important to phase that out.
So what we're saying is, and this is what we always ask our clients, right? Okay, what do you want to do? And then wind that back. They go, I want to buy a property. They go, no, hold on a sec. What do you want to do 10 to 15 years down the track? Where do you want to be?
Reverse engineer it.
And then reverse engineer it, absolutely.
Yeah. So that brings me to one of the phrases you guys have thrown around a little bit this morning, this afternoon, today.
today would be easier.
And that is the debt recycling. So explain to the listeners what debt recycling is.
Sounds good. I can probably do it in one sentence and then we'll dive into it a bit deeper. Yeah,
with a disclaimer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds good. So debt recycling is converting your non-deductible PPOR loan into a deductible investment loan, so you can claim those interest charges at tax time. Probably the easiest example I'll give for it is, say you've got a 500K loan, 500K in the offset account, just a nice easy example. Client wants to keep 250K buffer for personal use, but they're happy to put that 250K towards the investment portfolio. You can cut the loan into two, so 250K, 250K. First loan split, you transfer 249K into the loan, re-borrow that for your deposit and closing costs of the next investment property. That loan split is now tax deductible because you've split it off your non-deductible home loan and created a nice audit trail for your accountant.
As long as those funds get used
for investment purposes. So essentially the offset facility, which is, I guess, theoretically slash technically a savings account, if you were to use that for the deposits as from an offset, it's non-deductible, as opposed to recycling it into a with a different label, essentially, slash different product, it then becomes deductible, but check with your accountant, there's the disclaimer.
Exactly.
But it's a very, very, it's starting to be a very commonly used expression, is this debt recycling.
And it's so important to get right, because not only does it help your tax situation, but it also helps your future borrowing situation. Because back to your example, Wayno, $500,000 worth of owner-occupied debt, you're not going to be able to borrow as much as if you had $250,000 of owner-occupied and $250,000 of investment debt, because how banks calculate how much you can borrow includes what's called a negative gearing add-back. Now, I mean, that's just a technical term for the bank saying, oh, okay, that's an investment loan, is it? So I'm actually going to allow you to claim a little bit more tax back in your serviceability calculations, meaning your cash flow is higher because you're getting more tax refund.
So that's about recycling debt for, I guess, better purposes at the end of the day. But Vic and I did a podcast months ago about the five finance musts to protect and enhance your capacity. So yeah, we think we know a little bit about finance after doing it a few years, but you guys ultimately know a hell of a lot more. But these are the points we made: was one, not non-deductible debt, which is
debt recycling.
Yep, debt recycling, mm-hmm. repayment structure, equity harvesting, income lender selection, and asset selection. So let's go to the back one first, which is lender selection and asset selection. And what we, and you guys can explain a little further, but what we really were describing in that is that it's not always about the rate. The lender has a big part to play in it, depending on what the opportunity that you're looking at and what it's going to derive for you over time. And that lender selection and asset selection actually go hand in hand if you want to get the most out of it.
Exactly. And I think probably the first point around that is because we want to grow a portfolio, you need to go to lenders that are going to allow you to release equity to propel it. So that's potentially the first port of call. The mainstream lenders are generally pretty good with equity releases, a couple of hundred K at a time, compared to some smaller lenders that will cap it at 50K, mm-hmm. which just makes it hard to grow the portfolio from the get-go. Mm. There's also, I guess, a spectrum or tier of lenders where the borrowing capacity is different. So it may be, hey, lender one, you can borrow 400K, lender two, you can borrow 600K, but the rate's slightly higher. And then you get to make that call around the asset selection that you're going to target.
Yeah. So given that, the cost of money to most lenders is relatively the same, how can you borrow less with one lender and borrow more with another?
That's a good question. And I guess it's in their serviceability calculations, mm-hmm. because if every lender let you borrow the same amount and everyone had different interest rates, you'd just go to the lender with the best interest rate, right? Mm-hmm. So they've created a market, and I guess it probably comes down to what lenders fall under APRA's umbrella. So the mainstream lenders are under that they've got to comply, and they're probably the most conservative with borrowing capacity. Once you move away from that, there's more generous lenders, and probably the main thing to that is how they assess existing debt. So they might take the existing repayment with a 20% buffer, mm-hmm. versus expensing the loan over the P&I term with some of the mainstreams. And there's those little tweaks within each different lender that's a little bit different, where we can really take our clients based on their situation and go, hey, we can go to this lender and tweak one, or hey, your situation's a little bit different. This lender's most suited to you and going to put you in the best borrowing. Yeah. Capacity.
For example, like if there's a borrower who lives at home, a lot of lenders will say, well, you're not paying any rent and you're not paying any board, but there's a good chance you might get kicked out, or not a good chance, but like there's always a chance that you might get kicked out. So even though you don't actually pay it, and you know, you can get a letter saying, oh, I live at home, rent free, board free, a lot of lenders will still deem that you're paying a minimum of $600 a month as a notional rent. However, the flip side is that there are lenders that will go, oh, so you're not paying any rent or board? Okay, we're not going to include it in. And then all of a sudden, that's an extra $600 a month to your cash flow that you're going to be able to service more debt with.
Mm. And the bottom line to that is you will pay for it, and you will pay for that via potentially a higher rate. So what's worth more to you at the end of the day? Because then, like, that's an elevated risk. And I guess it's in the banks, in the lender's eyes, the higher the risk on what they deem as risk, the higher the rate. It's as simple as that. You could equate it to go get yourself a 50% loan to value ratio, see what the rate is, go get one at 90% and see what the rate is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The point is, if your goal in line with your household budget, in line with the opportunity that you're looking at, and you pay an extra 25 basis points for that ability because you're living at home and they say that's cool.
Well, you calculate it.
Right?
I mean, yeah. Like what's 0.25% of a $500,000 loan but versus what's 5% growth on that $500,000 property?
Good point. Mm-hmm. Great point. And maybe another way to look at it in terms of those tweaks that Wayne was talking about is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but some lenders will take in more rent as a percentage
Yeah, spot on. So some lenders shade your rental income by 10%, some 20%, some 30%. So you're kind of mixing policies between every different lender to funnel it out into the best couple and give those options across the board.
So I guess the cardinal mistake most investors make is that they stick with a bank that they've always banked with and the banks they've heard of. Or banks that actually they can physically walk into because they like the touch and feel and be able to talk to someone. But the reality of it is that when you're building a portfolio, we need to take a global look and say, okay, where's my best opportunity? Where's the best bang for buck for my type of income I've got right now and what I'm trying to do with this property? Right? And a really good example of this would be there are two lenders with exactly the same rate, but one does not support construction, the other one does, and the property I'm buying, I'm looking at building a granny flat. So the choice is pretty obvious there, isn't it?
100%. It ties in what the plans are for the property and what you're going to do to keep growing the portfolio. So I think rates almost on the second tier of things, you want to look at, you know, equity release policy, construction policy, you know, different functions like offset accounts, redraw, which most lenders have. But I think if you're just solely looking at rate, you're going to get stuck pretty soon. So I think you're almost forced into lender diversification based on serviceability as the portfolio grows.
Not to mention, if you stay with one lender, a lot of the times it means that they have the opportunity to charge you a higher rate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you actually have a loyalty tax where you know, a lot of people would have thought the otherwise. They would have thought, oh, you know, I've been with this bank for 20 years. Surely they look after me.
And we see that on a daily basis, yeah, especially from the majors with three letters. Like this.
The dollar mine accounts, I think. I've been there for 30 years. They're going to give me a better deal, right?
Yeah. But you know, often they'll give new business a better rate than they will
always,
existing rate.
And always.
So it does pay to very carefully shop around, but I'd suggest that you don't do it yourself, that you do get the broker to do it so that we're not in having any sort of effect on your credit file. Your time consumptions. The broker's going to have everything in front of them. So let them go to market on your behalf. Now, the fourth absolute finance must was income, and that's pretty self-explanatory, right? You need to earn money. You need, other than the physicality of it and supporting your lifestyle and the portfolio, the banks want to see income, and they don't necessarily want to see you refinancing your properties to live off that. It's not even a matter of they don't necessarily want to see it. They don't want to see it. It's not genuine income. So the way that we sort of package that up is, if you're having a really good run with your portfolio and life is good, don't quit your day job. Don't lose sight of that PAYG. Or if you're self-employed, pay your tax. Don't do the cashies because it doesn't work both ends. And it's illegal, just saying. So pay your tax, earn your money, show what you're earning so that the banks give you a better chance, deal, whatever it may be. But income is clearly at the beginning of everything. Earn the money, otherwise the banks won't give you the money.
And it's probably the hardest thing to change. And probably to your point, I guess it comes down to a lot of self-employed clients as well, where they may reduce their income on paper, but if you're not earning an income or you're not profitable, it's going to be pretty hard to borrow. Probably with the rate rises, the lenders started bringing in debt to income ratio restrictions. So a lot of the mainstream lenders brought in a 6 DTI. But because the rates have jumped so much, that's probably out of the park now. You actually hit your serviceability limit before we can get someone to a 6 DTI. And probably with some of the more generous lenders, we were seeing kind of 8, 9 DTIs, which is calculated to take that on, as we were talking about before. But it just shows you how much they're not willing to lend based on that multiple of your income now.
And if we tie that back to certain locations in and around DTI, so debt to income ratios, we can usually see why the areas with the better debt to income ratios, therefore more affordability based on income per capita for that locality, does better in a higher interest rate environment, right? And technically, the ones with a higher DTI should really, really suffer and see more volume of stock on market and what have you. So let's bracket that up and say Sydney. But this cycle is different. But because there's such of a lack of supply, we're not seeing those elevated listing stock numbers, no matter what the DTI is, because people have got no option other than to keep. Now, that sounds like a really weird statement in and amongst affordability, but if they were to sell, where do they go to? Where do they upsize, downsize to? Where do they rent when there's nothing there? So people are hanging on, is my assumption,
mm-hmm.
because there's really no other alternative. Yep. And it can be cheaper to own it than to rent it.
Absolutely it is, especially in a time like this, right? And one of the things that we continually say to our clients, Steve, is that you need to forward plan everything, right? So if you're going to have changes in your income, changes in your family, so let's say you're going to start a family. One of the things we do from a portfolio point of view is to say, okay, well, let's bring forward a granny flat construction. Let's boost up the cash flow. But equally importantly, Wayne, you'd be seeing that from your client level when we send clients across, is that we want to be looking at a forward projection to say, okay, we're buying properties now, but perhaps in 3, 4, 5 years' time, we're going to start a family. And we're not reverse engineered to say a couple of years before that we've restructured everything to maximize our borrowing, free up all of our equity. So it takes away the pressure of holding onto properties in the leaner years as cash flow is concerned.
Exactly. You've got that buffer there. So it's not as stressful for the household. And because you've planned it 3 years ahead, there's probably another revision for it just as it's about to happen mm-hmm. again. So you've got two checkpoints to look at the portfolio, make sure everything's set up strategically, make sure you're not making that forced sale.
Which then brings us, because you touched on it, Vic, is to that equity harvesting. Mm-hmm. So that's what we spoke about earlier on, being liquid. So you know, when you can, you should. But it does, just on that point, just very quickly though, when we refer to being liquid, and drawing down that equity, parking it in itself so it's not costing you, but it's attainable, becomes a very fine line with potential future borrowing, doesn't it? Because if you're drawing down equity, you're adding to the potential global debt limit. And if the plan is still to purchase in the near term or even the medium term, then the broker will be running that, I guess, that line in terms of how much you can draw down, but how much can you still borrow should you want to or need to.
We're seeing that a lot now, and you know, pre-rate riser was, you know, 80-90% purchases most of the time, drawing down on that 10%, 20% equity for your deposit. But now probably what we've been doing for clients is generally that equity lending's on a better rate, so you know, why don't we take a 30% deposit from the equity and borrow 70% on the higher rate for the pre-approval, so your global cash flow's a lot better. You've still lent 105% of the purchase price, but you've just been really strategic around where you're taking the money, and it's helping your serviceability because, as you said, that equity lending's adding to your global debt, but how can we use it in this environment?
So that's a really good point, and I just want to repeat that just in case the listener missed it. In the theory is you should borrow as much, well, yeah, to a degree, you should leverage as hard as you can and as much of the bank's money. However, in today's environment, there are certain times where it's actually better to reduce your LVR position down to 70%, so therefore a 30% deposit.
I think a good rule of thumb is, like, equity is always king. You know, having it there is just no downside. Like, the banks will, every additional dollar of equity that you borrow means a dollar less you have to borrow in future because you've already borrowed it up front. But the equity, as we were saying, it can play the part of giving you a bigger deposit, meaning it gives you a better and or easier deal for when you're buying the next investment property. But it's also your risk mitigation, right? If anything goes wrong, you lose your job or you know, you come into a cash crisis or whatever it is, it's there. Like, it's both an opportunistic bucket, but it's also a risk mitigation bucket. So, like, we are such a huge fan of it.
Yep. Mm. And fast forward another 12 months or 24 months, whatever it is, when things do get easier, those clients that have bought a property to 70% LVR, there's 10% equity there ready to grab, you know, and be that with the same lender or coming back to a more favorable lender, that can help you leapfrog into that next property.
Correct. And then we've got the repayment structure, because I guess on the surface, it's from a cash flow sort of consolidation period, interest only is technically better, right? However, there are times when P&I might, I guess, be the necessity, but also it doesn't necessarily always harm the serviceability, I guess, in totality.
100%. So I think it's pretty nuanced in terms of serviceability. So P&I lendings look more favourably with the mainstream lenders, but probably what we see when we run the numbers is taking P&I on that debt isn't going to get you that next property. It's not going to be the difference between buying number three and getting to number four. What we find is probably the difference is taking that interest-only lending on your investment debt, because that can help your borrowing capacity significantly with some of the smaller tier lenders. And that's what we find can be the difference between that next property or not.
So going P&I on potentially a drawdown of a home, but then keeping it interest only on an investment, or the other way around?
Keeping all your investment lending interest only.
Interest only, correct. And then, of course, we've got the non-deductible debt. And this is the only way I really can describe this is anything that's non-deductible. If we strip out accommodation, therefore dwellings, it's really the car loan, the credit card, the boat loan.
Student loans.
The Bentley loan.
No loans on the Bentleys.
Oh, Bentleys. Was that plural? Or was that singular? You got another one of you. But is it right in saying that the equation still is for every dollar of non-deductible debt, it's really eradicating potentially $5 worth of productive debt, i.e. home loan?
I probably wouldn't say it's that much of a multiple. I think for every dollar of non-deductible debt you've got, it's probably $1.5, $2 of investment debt that you can't get. So that's where that debt recycling process can really help.
But I think what you're referring to, Steve, is the consumer debt.
Consumer debt,
that correct. is amortized over like a 5 or 7 year like car loan, for instance.
Correct.
Or personal loan.
Credit card. I think to your example, for every $1,000 credit card limit you have, it's probably 5K drop in your loan amount.
So that's a hell of a lot. Yeah. So let's revert back to the car loan, because a lot of people do that and pay structures and what have you. But if you've got a $50,000 car loan, would it be right in saying that it's somewhere between $200,000 to $250,000 worth of
between 250 to 300 probably.
Yeah.
So that's a huge amount.
Because you've got to remember that when you buy an investment property, not only are you taking on debt, but you're also getting the rental income from that, right? So that makes it easier to service all round. It's deductible debt, plus you get the rental income versus a car, which, you get to drive around, it's nice and shiny, but you don't get any other benefit. And the loan term is squashed into 3, 5, best case 7 years.
Have a client that's a tradie, and tradies typically go out and buy the Toyota Ute, the Ranger Ute, and they're pretty expensive. They're
unbreakable.
So they're in excess of $100,000, right? And have a client that did that, but wanted to invest in property, so it was going to be his first property, and give him full credit, right? Because he didn't have the borrowing capacity, because he just loaded up $100,000 worth of car debt. So he sold the car. He put him into a position with his deposit to be able to buy a $600,000 investment property. So the $100,000 worth of cool ute, Land Cruiser ute.
Depreciating asset,
big repayments, et cetera, et cetera, was actually his handbrake, no pun intended, to being able to actually do anything in terms of investment, investment class. And credit to him to say, you know what, well, that's just sheer stupidity, and be gone with the ute. Yep. And literally within 3 months, he sold the ute, got the finance, and bought an investment property, which is, back then, it's now climbed by 20%. Yep. So it's like happy days. Like good on him for seeing through the rubbish.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can do it the other way around, as in like you can buy the investment property or two or three investment properties, and you go, you know what, I'm probably going to be happy with that for the next 3 to 5 years.
Then buy the ute.
You're still going to qualify for the, a lot of the times you're still going to qualify for the vehicle finance.
Or pretty hard not to.
Yeah. Or to throw in the kicker, I guess, if there's equity in the portfolio and you do want to use that to put towards the ute within the business, why not reverse it and do it the other way around? Yeah,
which is the least harmful in terms of capacity, isn't it?
Exactly. And physical cash flow.
Yeah,
absolutely. So we're quickly running out of time. So there's two other things I think we need to talk about pretty quickly. The first is commercial and SMSF. So let's go with SMSF. How are you finding now that because of people's inability due to lending circumstances, being able to purchase in their own names or their trust, are you starting to see a big convert now towards people that are saying, you know what, well, I've got $150,000, $200,000, $300,000 in my fund, I'm rolling that over into an SMSF and I'm going to buy in my SMSF, which doesn't affect the physicality of the household budget?
100%. We're having those conversations often now. And I think that really important point is if you've loaded up and your serviceability is capped in your personal scenario, that gets completely ignored in the SMSF situation. So it's really helpful for clients that are still wanting to grow. And probably what we've seen is some of the lenders coming in with 90% SMSF loans.
It's crazy. Good,
yeah,
but crazy.
Which is awesome. It's a new product, and I guess there is an LMI cost to it, but it may be the difference between buying one property or two properties in the short term.
Yeah, and that's obviously something to speak about with your accountant if you're entertaining creating an SMSF, because there is a fair bit of complexity to it. There's a lot of red tape, as there probably shouldn't be, but it's a well-governed vehicle that takes or necessitates a certain type of advice.
There's a bit of cost as well.
In terms of
setting it all, getting it all set up front and also running it. So there's the audits, the books that you need to keep, the compliance that you need to keep ongoing. But when you weigh it up against the benefit of the long-term tax considerations that your accountant can share with you and deem whether it's appropriate for your situation, a lot of the times we're finding, you know, a lot of our clients are coming back and going, yeah, it's a big green light.
Exactly. Mm. And probably a nice kicker is there are some lenders that offer offset accounts with it as well. So,
yeah,
you know, you can leverage it up to 90 or 80, and if you can put your leftover cash in that offset account, which is offsetting a 7 or 8% interest rate, and then when rates come down to X amount over some point in time and you think you can get a better return on that money, you can put it back into shares or something that's going to yield a higher return. So you've got that flexibility with the SMSF portfolio.
Absolutely. So if you are entertaining, or perhaps now you are an SMSF, so a self-managed super fund, do speak to your accountant. Make sure you get the appropriate advice. And the last one is commercial loans. So if we go back a couple of years ago where there was some super competitive commercial rates, as good, if not in some cases, arguably better than resi or investment resi, and there were different products. There was the lease doc loan, there was obviously full doc, low doc, what have you. The question that we often get is, please explain a lease doc loan and what are the pros and cons against it in terms of time frames and how long do they last for? And the next question is, in today's environment, what is the current rate for commercial? But let's start with the lease doc.
Yeah, perfect. So lease doc's nice and simple. You get a lend based on the purchase price and the rental return. So pre-rate rise, you're probably getting up to a 70% lend. We're seeing that's probably dropped down to a 55% lend. The loan terms based on, it's called WALE, weighted average lease agreement. So if you've got a 4-year lease, you generally get a 3-year loan term and they'll do an annual review. The rates aren't too dissimilar to kind of resi investment lending. So you're probably looking in that kind of mid sixes, 7% range at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Which is, on the surface, sounds really, really competitive and good versus resi, but two very key points there that you mentioned. A, the LVR is somewhere between 60 and 70%, so that's a massive cash contribution, no matter where it comes from. And the second is it's only, the term of the loan is not like resi where it's 25, 30 years with 5 years interest only. The entire loan term with a lease doc loan is tied to how long the lease is. So that could be 2, 3, 4 years.
Yep.
So be very, I guess, aware of the pros and cons. And the next question is, because we get asked this a lot, and we sporadically buy commercial when we see that it's the timing to buy commercial. At the moment, what are commercial rates at the moment? Like, let's break it into low doc and full doc, and what are their LVRs and their repayment structure and rate cost?
Sounds good. So I think we touched on lease doc, that 65 to 55 LVR with rates in the mid sixes, 7%. The other option is a full doc commercial loan where they'll tie in your personal situation and a full serviceability based on your resi portfolio and income. Benefit to that is you can get 15, 25 year loan terms. So you're not having those, you know, reviews when the lease is expiring. Trade off with those is they generally come with a slightly higher rate, so probably about 0.5% higher.
And then if we're talking about low doc, light doc, alt doc, all of that kind of stuff, you add another, you know, 0.5% to 1%, maybe 1.5%. And then if we're talking about like no doc and, you know, private lending and that kind of stuff, all those black arts. So the rate is really up there as well. So add another 2-3% on top of that.
So commercial lending really is something that's far more, I guess, commercially detailed in its end result and in entirety, and it's something that you should really think about, and why a broker is I guess very important in the scheme of things, because we can see some of the commercial investors now in the general public being stuck at the end of those lease doc loans and going into a much different LVR position or being a review situation, which is something that you don't get in resi unless you've put yourself into a foolish position. I think in like even on that, I think in 3 years of doing this, I think I've only ever seen maybe two residential investors be called in in terms of their LVR positions.
But that can happen.
It can happen. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But usually it's triggered by something, right?
Yeah.
And lastly, just it's not a really good story, I guess, but I was watching some of the auction results on the weekend and the media in and around mortgagee possession sales. And there were some people from the commentary side of things that were expecting that mortgagee sales and arrears would be through the roof based on the interest rates environments that we have now. But interestingly enough, that it is like a fraction, and I mean a fraction of what it was and what was experienced during the GFC. So we're not really seeing those, I guess, scaled mortgagee and possessions. Nonetheless, there are some there. There are some that are starting to appear, and there are expectations with the mortgage rate fixed cliff that there could be some towards the tail end of the year. And there was a really interesting one on the weekend, a mortgagee and possession sale. And typically what mortgagee and possession sales have to do is they need to go to auction because it's got to be best and fairest on the day. And this particular house, which we talked about on the Facebook Live, well, that auction has now happened. And how it rolled out was there was only a couple of registered bidders. They only went up to let's call it a stealable price, which would make sense from an investing point of view to steal it, but it was passed in because it didn't reach its reserve. However, what some lenders do via the I don't know how you phrase them up, but the liquidation company of mortgages, they usually can have two reserves. So it's the reserve at, let's just round it out to $1 million, but if there's no activity or if we're close, we've got our second line reserve, which could be, you know, 950, 900, or whatever it may be. And back in the day in the GFC where there are a lot of those, it was nearly a weekly, event for us where we do two or three mortgagee in possession sales. And as I've mentioned on a couple of podcasts now, I don't think I've done more than three now.
In the whole year?
I'm going to say 2 years, really. So it's certainly a different environment, but it's, I guess, a better way to explain it is same, but different, Vic.
Indeed. Now, that's been fun having you two in the studios.
Thanks for having us.
We've certainly learned a lot, tapping into my two best minds in finance in Australia.
Thanks, Vic.
Now, we'll leave your contact details in the show notes. And for those that are listening, depending on which platform you're listening, give us a thumbs up, give us a like, give us a comment or a 5-star rating. It does help the algorithm and allows us to reach more people to give the pertinent information we do with property investing. Until next time, it's goodbye.
The information featured in this podcast is general in nature, does not take into consideration your financial situation or individual needs, and should not be relied upon. Before making any investment, insurance, tax, property, or financial planning decision, you should consult a licensed professional who can advise whether your decision is appropriate for you.